I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Who will win the next UK general election? Hello, I'm Lucy Fisher, and this is Political Fix from the Financial Times. After the Tories suffered major losses in last week's mayoral and council elections, we're taking stock and looking ahead. Coming up, we're making available an FT's Inside Politics subscriber webinar where I was joined by my FT colleagues Camilla Cavendish, George Parker and Stephen Bush, all on hand to answer questions from viewers. I kicked off with a question to Stephen, asking him what his takeaways were from the local elections.
The ones which are the most interesting are your classic marginals, Redditch, Nuneaton and Bedworth, Cannock Chase, and then Harlow. Now, the thing which is different about Harlow to those first three is the Labour Party won those first three at a canter, confirming all of the indications we have that the Labour Party is going to win the next election. Under Jeremy Corbyn in particular, and also under Ed Miliband, they did very well at adding lots of extra graduates in seats they already held. What they are clearly doing under Keir Starmer is they are losing some of those votes they'd gained under Corbyn and Miliband in the city centres, and they are gaining lots of additional votes in marginal constituencies, with one quite interesting exception, which is, and I'm sure some people who are in Harlow would get very annoyed hearing me say this, in outer London, both its actual political boundaries, but those places which actually, when you think about it, they are firmly within London's economic orbit. I think that to me has been the really interesting thing about this election, confirming the extent of the Labour lead, but also confirming a kind of fascinating pattern of some geographical exceptions to that lead.
And Camilla, there's been some questions about what the results of the loss of 475 odd councillors by the Tories means for the party. Gwyn Bevan asks, what impact do you think the loss of Conservative councillors will have on the party's organisational capability to get people to come out and vote in the general election?
Well, he's sort of answered his own question brilliantly because, I mean, there are two major impacts. One is clearly morale for the party. And we know that Sunak has seen off a leadership challenge, partly just because it would have been absurd to have yet another prime minister who was not elected. But the really core issue here is exactly what you just mentioned, which is the councillors in the Conservative Party are the people who get the vote out. They're the people who put the leaflets through the doors, and they are the machinery on the ground. And this rout of councillors will make a real difference to their ability to do that in the general election.
And George, there's been many questions, and put most succinctly by Anil Patel. When is the general election going to be off the back of last week's results?
Well, I think the one thing we can be sure of, it's not going to be in the summer, before the summer break. There was a scenario where if the results had been so bad that there had been some sort of Conservative mutiny uprising against Rishi Sunak, and that Rishi Sunak might have dashed to the palace to call an early election to head off this complete breakdown in his party. That didn't happen. The rebellion fizzled and spluttered out on the Friday morning, actually, of the elections. Neither was there sufficient glimmers of hope in the results, if any at all, for that matter, to encourage him to go early in July. So the assumption's got to be it's going to be an autumn election. People talk about October. My hunch is still it's more likely to be November. They will play it out as long as they possibly can, hoping that interest rate cuts begin at the Bank of England. We're expecting some better economic news this week in terms of the economy moving out of a technical recession. We're also expecting later this month inflation to return to 2%. And there are hopes in the Treasury that interest rates will start to be cut either in June or in August. So they see hoping that might be a psychological moment. If that happens, mini budget at the beginning of September, party conference at the beginning of October as a rally effectively, and then into an election campaign.
Can I just say, there's one other factor that might influence this, which is these party conferences. Mm. If I was advising Rishi Sunak, I would advise him to go in September. Mm. And the reason is because Labour will raise a huge amount of money at their party conference. They did last year. Their party conference will be the galvanising moment you talked about. it will not be that for the Tory party. Rishi Sunak is not that leader. So actually, in terms of money, and don't forget, money is quite an important issue in elections. I think there's an argument that he might go in September, although I generally agree that it's more likely to be November.
That would involve campaigning over the summer holidays, though, wouldn't it?
Well, if you went at the end of September, you know, you could knock out Labour's party conference, which I think is a significant milestone. And given how shrewdly Starmer has played it, he will be able to play that to the max. He will have every business will be there. We saw that last year. It is that is where the party is galvanising, getting momentum from the business community.
Yeah.
Okay, so Camilla, you think Rishi Sunak might ruin our summer holidays?
Well, I'm hoping not, but I'm just saying that's one thing that's strategists will be suggesting. I'm
one
sure.
possibility. And Stephen, you think he might yet still ruin our Christmas holidays?
Yeah. One of the reasons why parties, when they start losing, tends to get worse before it gets better, is they often aren't set up for someone to go, hey, boss, have you noticed that your opponent is quite good at some things? And so it's really hard to admit that you would actually be better off not having your conference, but the other lot would be better off having theirs, because that's to admit that there are some things that the other guy's doing better than yours. The thing is January is like the non-decision decision, right? It's the thing which involves upsetting no one in the party. It involves not going earlier when the polls are bad. Now, while it would be a catastrophically stupid idea to go in January, often when parties are in trouble, the non-decision is the one which gets made. So although I think George is right, the thing which frightens me in terms of ruining my own social plans is a Christmas dominated by an election.
But it's also the Micawber theory, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you are in number 10 and you want to remain in number 10, question, does Sunak actually want to remain in number 10? I'm assuming he does, but he's having a pretty tough run of it. Then you just hope something will turn up. Yeah.
Now, what I was interested in the scores of questions we had is almost everyone assumed that we are heading for a Labour government of some flavour. Before we get to the questions about what a Labour government might look like and what might happen to the Conservatives after a defeat, Taha Dohodwala asked, what last-ditch effort will the Tories pull to stay in power? And is there any chance it could work, George?
It's interesting that in the immediate aftermath of last week's elections, they sent out Mark Harper, the Transport Secretary, to deliver the message, which is the message of Isaac Levido, the Conservative election strategist, campaign chief, which is we have to have a plan, we have to stick to the plan, and we deliver on what people care about. Now, it doesn't sound very exciting, but Isaac Levido is convinced that throwing out gimmicks at this stage is a completely wasteful exercise. You basically stick to what you're doing. So I mentioned some of their better economic news they're hoping for. They're hoping to have an autumn statement of fiscal event in the beginning of September, where if the economic circumstances allow, they'll cut national insurance by another 2p in the pound, which would mean they could claim they'd halved national insurance contributions in the space of a year, and that would be a down payment. Other than that, of course, we've talked a lot about, everyone's talked a lot about the idea of flights going to Rwanda with migrants. Now, we expect that to happen before the summer holidays. The problem for the Conservatives, of course, then is we have an August where lots more people come over the channel. It doesn't have a deterrent effect, and people just say, what on earth is the point of this vastly expensive policy? But beyond that, they've done defence spending, they've done crackdown on welfare, they've done all the things you would expect a Conservative government to do going into an election. Beyond that, I think they're hoping that waiting lists will come down hospitals, but time's running out.
Camilla, Hannah Marshall asks a related question. What factors and events do you think are most likely to affect the outcome of the UK general election? And are there any plausible scenarios in which the predictions are wrong and Labour don't win?
Is there a plausible scenario? I mean, there are implausible scenarios. It's really unusual, this one, isn't it? I mean, it's unusual and it's also quite dispiriting in a way for everyone in politics, because when you feel the weight of this, it means that the opposition doesn't really have to be clear about its own policy, and the government gets into this tailspin where they're not actually thinking for the long term. And it is actually quite a dispiriting moment. I think after 13 years in power, I don't think any political party has ever won another term after 13 years. So, I mean, for me, ignore the incompetence and the political instability we've had. Just the sheer weight of years, to me, means it really is inevitable that a government led by Starmer, I wouldn't say this of Jeremy Corbyn, is really very likely to win. And I don't actually see either the Liberal Democrats or the Greens or the SNP doing particularly well. I think, you know, the local elections, yes, the Greens had a bit of a surge. The Lib Dems have done quite well in the Southwest, but actually not as well as I would have expected them to do, even in the local elections. And I think, funnily enough, the Prime Minister's attempt to suggest there'd be a hung parliament is far more likely to make voters actually turn out and vote for Labour just to make sure they get in. I mean, I thought that was a very weird tactic. Mm. Because to be honest, the Tories' best hope was probably that everyone would assume there'd be a Labour government and they wouldn't bother to vote. Mm. So no, I don't personally think there are any plausible scenarios, although, you know, you may have other ideas.
Well, do you? I mean, Stephen, let's just turn to some of the smaller parties Camilla mentioned. Lots of people wanted to know. Emma Buckmaster asked, are people taking the Green Party seriously enough? Paul Kenny asked, how significant will the SNP's travails be to the outcome of the UK general election? Or do you think, as Camilla suggested, there will be this consolidation of the vote on the left because Rishi Sunak has told people it's going to be really close?
The big lesson of these local elections and the one before, and actually even the ones before that when the Conservative Party was doing better, was that, broadly speaking, once voters in this parliament have made the switch from Conservative to any of the other choices, they then seem to be treating them as pretty fungible, right? Then they'll vote Lib Dem if that's how they defeat the Tories. They'll vote Labour if that's how they defeat the Tories. Green voters are slightly less willing to vote tactically than Lib Dem or Labour voters, but I emphasise the word slightly less. We really are talking about the difference between, you know, being 70% likely and 60% likely, so still more likely than not. I think, you know, the Greens in particular have a problem because Rishi Sunak's messaging almost could have been written by Labour HQ. You know, it's not a done deal. Oh, there could be a hung parliament. These are all of the things that Labour wants to be able to say to people who are supporting one of the smaller progressive parties. For the Lib Dems, you'll come to the election and there are loads and loads of seats in which they are the natural anti-conservative lever. I think the problem for the Greens is that actually when you get to that point, there are only two seats that they are the viable challenger to, and those are both battles with the Labour Party. Battles where I think they are quite likely to win both Brighton Pavilion and Bristol Central. But other than that, they are the party which has the most to lose from the perception that the Conservatives do have a way out of this. Now, personally, I can't see how they would. And I think one of the other things we saw in this local election campaign is this was the campaign that Rishi Sunak wanted to fight. There actually weren't that many disruptions or noises off. And the ground that he wanted to fight it was, I would say, fairly obviously not a good idea. And they got a worse set of local election results than last time.
Just I'll pick up on the question about the SNP, because the projection from the national equivalent vote that Michael Thrasher, the elections expert, made, which he projected from a series of local elections onto what might happen to a general election, which lots of election experts said was a completely meaningless exercise and bad. It was a very bad way of projecting the general election. One of the things it did was it excluded Scotland because there were no local elections in Scotland. So his model assumed that Labour was going to win one seat.
That's right.
In Scotland, which is what they did in 2019, where if you speak to Labour people looking at the problems, the escalating problems of the SNP, they're hopeful of winning 25, 30 on a good night, even more than that in Scotland. And just pick up on the Lib Dem point, Camilla said she thought they could have done better. I thought it was actually quite a good night for the Liberal Democrats. They won more seats than the Conservatives, which I think they sort of slightly undersold it themselves, I thought. It was a very strange way the Lib Dems were talking about it, as if nothing's much to see here. But in fact, they won Dorset Council, which is a big, really strong Tory area. And that's ominous, I think, for the reasons Stephen pointed out, that across what you might call the near southwest, not the far southwest where I used to work, which used to be sort of Lib Dem stronghold. The Brexit effect is still playing out down there, Devon and Cornwall. But the further you come up towards London, Dorset, Somerset, Wiltshire, Gloucestershire, and then further in towards London, places like Wokingham, the Lib Dems are doing quite well. And I was just looking at the situation in Woking, it's a big Lib Dem target. There's not a single Conservative councillor on Woking Council anymore. Tunbridge Wells, where the Liberal Democrats seize control. All of those things are setting alarm bells ringing in central office.
There's an interesting dynamic in the farming community where the Conservatives seem to have lost the farming vote, which is a pretty basic component of the Conservative vote. And that is partly because post-Brexit, they have just not been able to make up their mind on what the deal was going to be for farmers. And actually, Keir Starmer has been reaching out to farmers quite effectively. It's very, very interesting watching where he's spending his time and where he's going to.
Well, that's a good straw in the wind on that. While we were still on the local elections, was about that the Labour Party won in York and North Yorkshire, Rishi Sunak's own constituency. And it's, you know, very well-heeled villages, pretty prosperous farms as well up there in that part of the world. For the Labour Party to win there was extraordinary. I don't really think the Conservatives saw that coming.
No. Well, let's also talk briefly about the Reform Party. Lots of interest in how they did in the local elections, but also what happens after the general election if the Tories lose. Peter Capel asked, will the UK right finally split into a Farageist ultra-white right-wing party and a moderate right-of-centre party? Should it split? Stephen?
Well, the problem is under our electoral system, which, given that it doesn't look like Labour's going to rely on another party to govern, is not going to change anytime soon. The parties have to be these kind of broad, slightly unwieldy tribes, otherwise they just get whomped by first past the post. To the extent that Reform has any political effect in the next election, and indeed to the extent they had any effect in these local elections, they merely sort of accelerated the trend of the Conservatives losing because they took extra votes to them for their right. I actually think in some ways it will have the reverse effect. And you even saw this in this election, right, where you had many, many seats where the Reform vote only made a difference to the Labour candidate's ego, right? The Labour candidate was going to win anyway, but thanks to that Reform vote, they went, oh, wow, I've won by loads. But it will be this sort of spectre in the Conservative Party of, oh, well, look, if only we'd got that 5 or 4% from the Reform Party, then we would have got 30% of the vote, not 25. I mean, but that will be the main effect of Reform. It'll be to allow the Conservative Party to go, actually, we don't need to change. We just need to be more like ourselves. And that will allow us to win these Farageist votes.
George, what kind of threat do you think Reform poses to the Tory party?
Well, if you looked at the pattern of local election results, they didn't stand in all that many seats, Stephen. Was it about 1 in 6?
Yeah.
1 in 6. But where they did stand, you could see the Conservative vote coming down. And obviously the other spectre that stalking Tory thoughts is Nigel Farage, the idea that he makes a return to the fray in the run-up to the general election itself. I mean, they plainly do pose a threat, but dealing with it is a massive trap for the Conservative Party, isn't it? Because, you know, we've heard this in the immediate aftermath of the elections. People like Suella Braverman or Robert Jenrick, two former Home Office ministers, saying we've got to be much tougher on immigration, leave the ECHR. All these things seem to me false prospectuses in terms of actually trying to shore up your position, because every time Suella Braverman or Robert Jenrick says stuff like this, you know, loads more votes are switching across to the Lib Dem column or the Labour column in other parts of the country where you have more moderate Tory voters. I think one of the lessons of the local elections are the Conservative candidates that did the best were people who tended to be of the moderate, one nation-y, frankly, in the case of Ben Houchen, who won in the Tees Valley, someone who benefited massively from the big state funding of Teesport, civil servants being moved into a Treasury campus in Darlington, Andy Street, so an incredibly inclusive, moderate Conservative. He lost, but only just, you know, defying a national trend. Those seem to me to be, or Harlow, actually another good example, where Dan Swords, a young leader of the council, very moderate, very highly regarded. Those seem to me to be the kind of people who win for the Conservatives. But the danger of fending off Reform UK is you end up going down an electoral coal sack, in my view.
Let's talk a bit about the campaign we're likely to have whenever the UK general election is. And I was struck that many subscribers wanted to know about how the international milieu might affect that. Tim Beerhelm, who's based in Belgium, asks, will the outcome of the European Parliament elections next month, he says, likely to increase in hard and far-right votes, and the campaign for the US presidential election, Trump's focus on identity politics, influence the build-up to the UK general election? Camilla?
I don't know is the answer. I mean, I think the EU is really wrestling with the problems of immigration. And that is sort of the unspoken issue. It is one of the issues in this election. You know, I totally agree with what you've both said about Reform and that the Tory party would be very foolish indeed to move further to the right. But I think it does reflect the fact that there are quite a number of people in this country who do not feel they are represented. And you now have a Labour Party that is much more university-educated, big city, liberal party. And immigration consistently polls as one of the top three things people care about, illegal immigration particularly, which is, of course, why Rishi Sunak got himself onto the hook of the small boats, because they could see that that was what people care about because they feel they haven't taken back control. So to the extent that the European parliamentary elections reflect that, and what you're saying, Lucy, is that they probably will because you're suggesting they'll move to the right, that may play a bit into our politics. I think, you know, we know that some of the discussion that's going on in the UK, which sounds outlandish, for example, leaving the ECHR, is also going on in many, many countries in Europe. And this question about sending people to a third country is also going on in many, many countries. So it may, I would have thought that's probably the main issue that might feed across.
Stephen, what do you think? I mean, Paul Melly asks, will any international issues affect the UK election? Peter Jenkins asks whether the war in Ukraine will have any impact.
Well, in some ways, the war in Ukraine is the most important external event in this election, right? Like, what was the beginning of the end of Boris Johnson's premiership? It was when the cost of living crisis started to make itself felt on the Conservative Party standing in the polls. And the war in Ukraine is a big part of that inflationary shock. And I think in many ways, the impact of most foreign policy and most politics outside of these shores will be that indirect thing where it's not how it plays out on the telly, but when you think about it, you go, oh, right, there's a link there. So let's take the Europe-wide sort of not just shift to the right, but the shift in the composition of the right in Europe. That will lead quite a lot of Conservatives to go, oh, you know, look, the future is Frederick Merz. The future is... Well, actually, I mean, a Conservative did say to me recently that they thought the future was Sebastian Kurz.
We'll, just explain to viewers so, that you're talking
so,
about the Austrian...
So he was the leader of the Austrian right, who kind of very successfully remoulded the Austrian right to move it in a more radical and populist direction. This, you know, young telegenic Austrian right winger sort of being able to kind of successfully keep the respectable traditional right and the rising radical right, you know, together in his coalition and to govern fairly successfully on those terms. There will be a lot of Conservatives pointing at that kind of result and going, well, look, they're doing better than us. Like, you know, whatever happens in the US presidential election, Donald Trump will get a considerably higher percentage of the vote than either party, because it's a different system. But people will nonetheless want to read across from that kind of thing. So all of that will add to the pressure to move to the right. But the central problem, exactly as Camilla says about being on this hook of the small boat, is that the Conservative Party have made a bunch of impossible promises on immigration. As a result, they're not trusted on immigration, and they're kind of, they become like a, you know, a junkie looking for their fix. You know, like, oh, I know, I just need more promises than I can't keep on immigration. You know, mega stop the boat. So, you know, a plane flight will save us. And it's, you know, the problem with an addiction is it always ends in the same way, a crash and a painful withdrawal.
It's funny that we've seen Robert Jenrick, the former immigration minister, suggesting the Home Office needs to be separated into a separate migration department, not a proposal I expect any government of the future to take up. George, what about UK-EU relations? We know that Labour's talking about a broad-based security pact with the EU that they might interpret in a very wide way to sort of boost economic links. Jan Blomart from the Netherlands asks whether this issue of a potential closer relationship between the UK and the EU will play any role in the upcoming general election and whether it could determine the result at all.
I think the answer to the second point is no and no. I don't think the EU will feature very prominently in the general election campaign, frankly, because as we've reported quite a lot on the FT, there's no interest of any of the main British political parties to talk about the EU or Brexit. It's too painful for the national psyche. The Conservatives don't want to talk about it because, frankly, it hasn't worked out very well. And Labour and the Liberal Democrats don't want to talk about it because they're trying to win back people who voted for Brexit. That isn't to say that I think there'll be some interesting things going on if Labour win the next election with the EU relationship. It's obviously going to be tough because Keir Starmer is sticking to the same red lines that Boris Johnson stuck to. And if you stick the same details into the computer, you're likely to get the same answer out the other end, which is no cherry picking and so forth. There's also an interesting subplot going on here. We're talking about the European elections, that as the European countries move to the right and in a more Eurosceptic direction, we're about to elect a centre-left pro-European party, potentially, in the UK. So we could end up with Britain having one of the more pro-European governments outside of the European Union. But on the specific question of what Keir Starmer might do, there is an acceptance in Labour circles that the original thinking was that there's a review of the trade deal that Boris Johnson struck, scheduled in 2025, 2026, which might be an opportunity to revisit some of this stuff. There's now an acceptance in Labour circles that the EU really isn't interested in a massive overhaul of that trade agreement. It's done and dusted. The European Union, frankly, as we've just been discussing, have got a lot of other things on their plate, including the war in Ukraine. They don't really want to get involved in a major new negotiation. But the Labour Party does see some scope of exploring this idea of a defence and security pact with the EU, which would have a number of effects. You could broaden that out beyond British participation in European security in a more structured way. I mean, we do have, along with France, the most effective armed forces in Europe and the best security sort of apparatus more generally. But they want to broaden out beyond that to other aspects of security, including energy security, border security, including migration. So it will be a way in which you can start to see British politicians re-engaging with European Union politics in a way they simply haven't been doing for the last 7 or 8 years.
Can I just say, I mean, I think this is an area where Labour actually have more policy than they're willing to talk about. And some of the other areas, they haven't got much policy at all, but they talk about it a lot. And as you say, George, it's all under the radar. So Starmer has essentially ruled out rejoining a customs union or a single market. Partly, of course, as you say, because we've already done bilateral trade deals. But this concept, I mean, having built the AUKUS deals, and to be fair, actually, to Rishi Sunak, he has massively improved the relationship with the EU. I mean, the last 18 months have been a complete vault fast in terms of the UK's relationship. So I think we shouldn't knock him too much on that.
No.
He's coming, obviously, from a low base. But I do think the AUKUS deal on submarines is really fundamental, with the US brought in as well. I think the EU can see that defence is absolutely critical. And in that sense, it may turn out the British government's been rather lucky that there has been a war in Ukraine. I mean, it's in fact the only upside you could imagine, because strategically, as you say, we are needed. The question is going to be, how shrewdly do Labour and David Lammy play that hand? Because we really have almost no cards, and we know that Brussels is not interested. But there are some really good people inside the Labour Party thinking very strategically about this, which has got to be encouraging.
I think we do have more cards than we think. I mean, you mentioned security and so on. I mean, there is certainly an interest in European Union countries having better access for their students to British universities and stuff. So,
But that's not a deal any British government will want to do, George, because we don't want to let them get away with only paying £9,000.
Exactly.
That's. I mean, there are many. There's a cost.
Yes.
There's an enormous cost to that one.
There is. That is certainly true. I think the point we're both making is going to be very transactional, isn't it?
And, yes. But the big prize is, can we reconnect our supply chains? Because the other side of this is, both political parties know the only way out of Britain's doom loop is economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, neither party has sufficiently explained a compelling argument for how they're going to reach that.
Mm.
And reversing some of Brexit is critical to that.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's not being debated in the political conversation is really outrageous, to be honest, because it means that we're just having to take the claims of both sides at face value. And while investors are, I think, happier if they get some form of political stability after the next election, it's still not clear how these supply chains are going to reconnect.
You can understand the Labour Party's position on this, can't you? They don't want to talk about this in such a hostile and unforgiving media environment before an election, because the moment you talk about it, you're on the front page of the Daily Mail being pilloried for undoing the benefits of Brexit. I think you're right.
I agree, but I think if you look at where the polls are, I mean, look, at the moment, you may have different views. I mean, Keir Starmer is playing it unbelievably safe. He's carrying the Ming vase slowly across the floor to victory. A lot of people in the Labour Party still can't quite believe they're going to win. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. And they're very nervous. But equally, I think they know that there isn't a full-throated excitement about voting for Keir Starmer in the way there was for Tony Blair in 97. And I do actually think, I totally understand what you mean. I'm not saying they should completely show their hand, but I also do think that the polls show buyer's remorse. People want some pragmatic solutions to the cost of living crisis and the problem of anemic economic growth.
Well, let's broaden out this question. I mean, Farhana Sheikh asks, what do you think will be Labour's agenda or first 100 days will look like if they're elected? Stephen?
Well, to be honest, the Labour Party doesn't quite know what its first 100 days will be. This is one of the, one of the big rouse is maybe putting it too strongly, but the most important person in the Labour Party in terms of those 100 days, and probably most people won't have heard of, or if they've heard of, they might not have thought about her for a while, is Lucy Powell, the shadow leader of the House, because her big job is talking to shadow ministers about what they want to do and going, okay, what do you have then is actually something that could go through the Houses of Parliament in those first 100 days. And so all of that is still pretty up in the air. Don't forget, for example, that things like the right to roam, which Labour brought in 1997, they weren't expecting to be part of the 100 days, but the shadow DEFRA team under Jack Cunningham, I think it was, just did have a pretty compelling set of well thought through policies. They wanted to be able to show they'd done something and it became something. So I think at the moment, it's impossible really to tell who's going to come through. But I think the teams that the leader's office feel are really on it are, you know, Shabana Mahmood, the Shadow Justice Secretary. So I think there'll probably be something about criminal justice in the first 100 days, simply because that's one of the shadow teams and is considered to be making the running and doing quite impressive things.
Interesting. And of course, some of the most radical proposals the government is sort of legally obliged to consult on, isn't it? So it can't just bring forward legislation straight away. George, Elizabeth Foster asks, given the Labour Party has committed to sticking with the Conservatives' spending plans, what do you expect will be the big changes to the UK economy and business sector under a Labour government?
Well, it's a good question from Elizabeth. And just picking up what Stephen said about the first 100 days, one of the things they've promised to do is to bring forward legislation on workers' rights. And I think they will do that, though that will be subject to consultation. Business will be involved. We've written a bit about the watering down that's been going on for the last few months and will carry on, I'm sure. But that will be one of the things that will be brought through. I think they're going to bring forward a devolution bill they've promised to give back control. Is that what it's called,
yeah,
Bill? Something like that. So it'll be something along those lines. And then coming to Elizabeth's question about the economy, we would expect there to be a budget fairly quickly after a Labour election victory. They're going to have to do a very quick spending review. You've been writing about this, Lucy. The current spending totals run out next April, so they'll need to address that. And then they'll be faced immediately with the consequences of adopting Conservative spending plans. The fact that we all know the pressures on public spending, whether it's on the ageing population or defence or decarbonisation, which then puts a huge amount of pressure on unprotected departments like justice, for example, like the Home Office, local councils. Everybody knows what normally happens is parties go into elections saying that they're going to, and I wrote about this actually, the extent to which Rachel Reeves and Jeremy Hunter's economics policies have converged. After the election, it might be a slightly different picture because all governments come in and they say they've looked at the books. Heavens, it's even worse than we thought. All governments put up taxes straight after an election. Who knows whether the Labour Party has a tax bombshell that we don't know about, but it seems to me quite likely if you're going to put up taxes that your first budget would be the time you do that. The key thing, I think, for all political parties coming in, and Tony Blair's been telling this to Keir Starmer, is you move quickly, do the difficult things early on in your lifetime of your government. Didn't Tony Blair say, right, I think it was maybe in his last conference speech, so when he came in, he had a huge amount of political capital but didn't know what he was doing. But by the time he knew what he was doing, all his political capital had gone.
This very much influenced David Cameron and George Osborne in 2008. I mean, Tony Blair said it in his memoirs. And actually, they were absolutely focused on that realisation that they... And they drew up very detailed, what they called at the time, business plans for every department that they wanted to implement in the first 100 days. So it's become, ever since, this kind of formula that every government, as you say, the most power you ever have is on day one. That when you're the Prime Minister, day one is when you have far more power, actually, because first of all, you have the power of patronage and appointment. But your power pretty much runs fairly thin from that time onwards. And I think the Labour Party are extremely conscious of this. But as you say, they're still working things out. Now, some things are costless to the Treasury. So the workers' rights package, which I actually don't believe is being watered down very much, I think this is a really open question, is costless to the Treasury. Now, it may cost business quite a lot in the long term, but it's costless to the Treasury. And I think there will be a number of things like that. You look desperately for something that doesn't, if ideally doesn't need primary legislation, but also doesn't actually mean you have to spend lots of money. As you've written, Lucy, I mean, clearly they will do the spending review. They will have to find, I suspect, a bit more money in tax. But they are slightly helped by the Conservatives who have already pushed up the spending envelope on the NHS and on defence. So actually, the commitment from the Conservatives to an NHS-costed workforce plan, which is an enormous unfunded spending commitment, does make it slightly easier for them because, in fact, you know, the architecture is already set. The question is then, can they afford to borrow more? What decisions will Rachel Reeves make about borrowing versus tax? And we don't yet know.
And I also think, you know, from the policies without a fiscal impact, we might see things like, you know, axing the hereditaries from the House of Lords, maybe some nanny status red tape measures on sugar by tills to sort of help the NHS without really giving it more money. Perhaps the ethics regime overhaul that Keir Starmer's also promised around raising standards in public life. But many subscribers are still concerned about the fiscal policies and the tax rises. Someone anonymous has just who's watching now has sent in a question. Stephen, do you think Rachel Reeves will have to set up some sort of tax on assets to fund ambitious investment plans? And I guess the flip side is that's been asked by quite a few people is around, really, are we going to see any significant improvement in our public services in a first Labour term, given the tight public finances?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, and everyone should read George's piece about Heavesism. I think we all know that both parties are running on a set of fiscal promises that obviously just can't be kept, right? Because they couldn't be kept in this parliament. So what do we think's changed? The difference is we know what the Conservatives not keeping their promises looked like. We don't know what the Labour Party not keeping the same set of promises will look like. I think the anonymous reader is right to guess that assets will be one of the areas that the Labour Party looks. Because in some ways, what did the Conservative parties do when they went, oh, wait, we can't keep these promises on tax and spending? They went, oh, let's raise taxes on working age people who don't vote for us anyway. What is the group in the economy? It's asset-rich pensioners. So my guess would be, if you're Rachel Reeves, and the first thing you do is like, is there a way I can get more out of the 25 to 30 to 32% of the country that's going to vote Conservative at this coming election? So yeah, I think taxes on assets will be part of how Labour seek to get out of this straitjacket that they've kind of ended up putting themselves in.
George, Konstantinos Koulacheris asks, would a single term be enough for a new government to address existing economic challenges in the country? And that reflects quite a few questions about just the scale of change we should or shouldn't expect from the next government.
Well, the simple answer is no, a single term isn't long enough. And it's one of the reasons why Keir Starmer talks about a decade of renewal, which sounds presumptuous, but privately, you speak to Labour Party people who are thinking about in terms of winning two terms. And a second term will open up, I think, a more interesting question about relationship with the European Union. I think probably we're too close to Brexit for a big transformational change in the relationship, but I think that's something we could be talking about. And they will hope that the kind of supply side reforms they put in place will start to bear fruit and allow them in the second term to increase spending on our public services. There's an interesting question about whether the economy comes to their rescue or not. You always get, when there's a change of government, especially a change of government after a long time, that it's a reset moment and people and investors look at the country in a slightly different way. And what are these new guys like? What are they about? And, you know, if there is a bit of if Labour wins, there will be a moment where people will maybe start to look at the country in a slightly different way. And, you know, if you get growth nudging up by 0.25% or 0.5%, that makes a big difference, actually, in terms of the amount of money you can spend on public services. So their hope will be that halfway through the next parliament, they'll be able to start turning on the taps on public spending, not quite to the extent that Gordon Brown did, of course, back in 1999-2000. But something along those lines, and go from there.
Can I just address the reform of public services question? Because I think this is so important. And certainly on the NHS, I'm pretty confident that Labour will bring a renewed energy to the problem that Wes Streeting really has got his head around the detail of the NHS, and that he will be pretty uncompromising, actually, in being able to challenge some of the vested interests within the NHS. And I think there is enormous scope for reform of public services. If you think back, we basically haven't had a government that's interested in reforming public services since 2016. Boris Johnson was absolutely not interested. Boris Johnson's entire prospectus was just throwing money at things. And we really have, as a result, got, I think, a number of public services that work for the producers rather than consumers now. Simultaneously, we know that Keir Starmer has hired Sue Gray to advise him on the Whitehall machinery, which I think also really does need a radical reset, George. And I think some of that you can do with a bit of a wing and the prayer because you come in with new energy. Mm. And let's face it, I mean, after 13 years in a pandemic, the Conservatives are exhausted. The Labour Party will have at least a new energy, possibly an idealism, maybe some naivety. But certainly with health, I think there are people in the health service who are hopeful. Mm. that maybe something will happen. And things like technology are vital to transforming the health service, the life sciences industry, and so on. And we have been really, really sluggish, despite conservative attempts to do that, because they have simply been blocked by the vested interests within the public services.
Mm. Well, someone watching has just messaged in to ask, are the defectors from the Tories to Labour genuinely at odds with the party? Or, as I suspect, are they just thinking of themselves first and looking to retain their seats? Now, actually, I think we should point out that Natalie Elphick, who's crossed the floor today, and Dan Poulter, who crossed last week, they are not actually standing for Labour at the next election. They're already Labour candidates in place. But is this about saving their own skin, their own reputation, Stephen?
I don't think so, to be honest. I mean, like, candidly, you know, Westminster is a very cynical town. And I think, if anything, Natalie Elphick's reputation has probably been harmed a bit by her defecting, because, you know, she hasn't been an MP for very long. You know, lots of people, you know, journalists, MPs in both parties will privately say, oh, isn't this about doing damage to Rishi Sunak? So there have been three defections from Conservative MPs. The first, Christian Wakeford, happened quite early on in the parliament, and lots of people were going, well, that's stupid. You know, he was going to hold that seat. Now he's not. Now he looks like he's probably made the right decision. But that was a defection which was clearly treated as an act of principle. And so it landed very differently in Westminster. I think particularly this third defection of Natalie Elphick, I can't see inside anyone's mind. So I'm not going to say I don't think that it's sincere. But I think that does mainly reflect what's going on in the Conservative Party. But, you know, let's be open-minded about it. It is also true to say that Rishi Sunak is pitching the Conservative Party in a considerably different place to the territory than Boris Johnson fought the 2019 election.
Well, that's certainly true. George, Neil Tritton asks, how few seats will the Tories win? And that was reflective of many questions that asked, is there a flaw? Could this be an extinction-level event like the Canadian Conservatives suffered in the 1990s, where they practically disappeared in an electoral cycle?
Well, it's a really good question. And obviously, you do meet some Conservative MPs who do talk about things in fairly apocalyptic terms. It's very hard to find Conservative MPs who think anything other than it's going to be a very, very bad election for the Conservatives. Whether it's sort of a sort of extinction type election, I think depends a lot on what happens between now and polling day, and whether the Conservative Party pulls itself together and determines that it wants to fight an election so that at least it's going to be in a competitive position for the election after this one, which basically means buttoning their lips, getting in behind the Prime Minister, hoping the economy comes through, and then campaigning as best they can on what they've delivered on the economy and so forth. It's, you know, you might argue it's a flimsy prospectus, but that is their best hope. The alternative scenario is you get a whole load of things, like the defection we saw at Prime Minister's Question Time, the whole sense of decay setting in, people like me and you, Lucy, writing stories about people hawking their CVs around the City of London, just the general sense that this party is completely broken. People hate the division. They hate this sort of internal fighting that's going on. It's the thing that really has really winding voters up. If they go into a kind of doom spiral between now and the election, then all bets are off. The only thing I'd say is that we've, and people like me, have had our fingers burned making predictions about elections a lot recently, whether it's the Brexit referendum, or the one that really haunts me was the Theresa May campaign in 2017, where everybody, she was up against a useless candidate, we all thought, Jeremy Corbyn, and she was riding high. There was empirical evidence that she was going to win a massive majority. She won a by-election in Cumbria a few months earlier. Mm. She'd just done incredibly well in local elections. All the actual evidence and the opinion poll suggested she was going to win by a landslide, and she ended up losing her majority. Now, this is a different situation. We're talking about a government which is, as Camilla was saying, exhausted after being in power for 14-odd years. But the electorate is fickle. It's not. Mm. The elections used to be decided by 5% of voters moving one way or the other. Now, it's much different. But anyway, it's kind of a long story short. It looks at this stage like it's going to be very bad, but I hesitate to predict how bad for the Tories.
Can I push either of you, Camilla or Stephen, on numbers or any more substantive sense of how bad it could be?
Look, the most alarming thing about these local elections for the Conservatives is that they finished third on seats behind the Liberal Democrats, but they were not third on votes. The thing about our electoral system is when a party becomes really unpopular and the type of targeted tactical voting against it becomes as intense as it clearly is for the Conservatives. And when its main opponent becomes as efficient in getting its votes in the right place, as all of the evidence suggests the Labour Party is, you know, like, quite apocalyptic results become possible. Now, because also British voters, as George says, have become much more volatile, much more willing to shop around, I'm not saying there's not some event of pith and moment that can somehow mean that the Conservatives win. But yeah, that's kind of like a 1 in 100 chance. Whereas I think there is probably about a 30% chance, particularly given that Rishi Sunak does not campaign well, that he, his final argument in this set of elections was that they were paying a failed asylum seeker from Africa $3,000 to make a new life in Rwanda. I mean, that if he wanted to design a policy to upset liberals, authoritarians, and that was his chosen closing argument. So the very real possibility that he'll end with a special fast track border policy for criminals in the general election shouldn't be ruled out. And voters are volatile, so under 100 is possible. I think something that looks a bit like 1997 is probably the central scenario right about now. So the central forecast is really bad. What happened to them last week was really bad. And voters are volatile. So, Canada 1993 is possible.
And if we assume the polls are right, the Tories are headed for a spell in opposition. Camilla, that probably means a new leader. I thought Tom McLaughlin asked it the question about whom that might be in an interesting way. Assuming Labour win, who would Prime Minister Starmer like or not like to see as the new leader of the opposition and why?
Goodness, what a great question. And by the way, just on the other point, I do think turnout will matter in this election. Mm-hmm. I think the danger for the Conservatives that there are a lot of apathetic Conservatives who don't vote at all is quite high. And that won't help them. Who would Starmer least like or most like to face? I mean, I have to be honest, I can't see anyone on the current roster that he should be particularly worried about. I think Kemi Badenoch is probably the most exciting and feisty of the possible candidates. She's very straight-talking, and she might be able to stand up to him on certain sort of cultural issues. Clearly, there is the sort of spectre of a Boris Johnson comeback. I always think that's overdone. I think Boris Johnson just likes every now and again to get attention by dangling these things. I don't believe he has any interest in coming back. He's actually quite a good performer. He'd be, in that sense, in the House of Commons, he'd be quite difficult. But his record is so shocking. And it's one of the reasons why so many Conservative voters have turned away from the Conservatives. So I think at the moment he's got a pretty open field. But remember that we're going to see a huge number of new MPs after the next election. I mean, we're going to see an absolute sea change. A lot of Conservatives are standing down anyway. Labour is heavily vetting a whole new swathe of candidates. It's going to be a very, very... I mean, we're going to have to do a big job on getting to know all these people. And there will be new characters. There are one or two people who probably will win Conservative seats who might be future leaders, but they are not in the current lineup.
It's been a fascinating discussion, but that's all we have time for today. So George Parker, Camilla Cavendish and Stephen Bush, thank you very much for your insights. And that's it for this episode of the FT's Political Fix. I've put a link in the show notes, along with free FT links to subjects discussed in the episode. There's also a link there to Stephen's award-winning Inside Politics newsletter. You'll get 30 days free. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. Plus, do leave a review or a star rating if you have time. It really helps us spread the word. Political Fix was presented by me, Lucy Fisher. The producer is Audrey Tinlin, and Manuela Saragossa is the executive producer. Original music and sound engineering by Breen Turner. Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. We'll meet again here next week.